time, we feel like we have this feeling that, oh, I am the best person in everybody's story and everyone else is the villain. They are trying to hurt me, they're trying to, I don't know, bit me, and they're trying to
abuse my kindness, exactly, and everything. And but you forget about the fact that we are a villain in a bad one in everyone's, in someone's story,
and that we are in contact with. And this is why you have to work on yourself at the first part of the story. And then you have to think about all the relationships that you have, even the tiniest one, even someone passing by from next to you in the metro station. Okay. Yeah. These are the communications that have their own specific effects. And
exactly.
The way you react to other people, the way they react to you, and all the and the combination is really perplexing, really complicated, and really beautiful. And I can tell you that I'm in love with this aspect of my life.
Yeah, it seems to be so supernatural, metaphysical.
Exactly.
Something that's got a lot of meaning. You know that there is a lot of hidden secrets back in there, but then understanding them, trying to reveal them to yourself is a big story.
Everything in this world has a purpose. And like mentioning about people, like, you know, the people we meet in our day-to-day life, the people that stay with us or they leave us. So everything has got a purpose behind it. So, you know, someone coming into my life or me meeting someone. So it's a test for me and it's a test for him who's coming into my life. So everything is a test. Like, you know, even something is happening with us. So as we know that, you know, this world is not the real world. It's the temporary station to all the humans. You know, the actual life is the hereafter.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends like how our actions are. So that will decide our afterlife.
Yeah, but the people that get to come into our life are going to define us in some ways. But then we're going to get into that more and more. But before that, let's go for a short break, after which we're going to have a lot to say.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Welcome back, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Well, this is your favorite Back to Reality. We're talking about an interesting topic, which is the people that get to come to our life story. Well, some of them turn out to be a reward. Some others turn out to be a torture. And there are different roles for the people that come into our lives. What do you think? Have you had more of rewards or have you had more of tortures?
I see all of them as rewards, even the tortures. I don't want to be sound like a cliche or an ideological person or something, but I really appreciate everyone that I've met in my whole life up to here.
Do you have in mind some encounters which was so important, which changed you drastically?
Yeah, for sure. I had so many encounters that really changed me, my behavior, the way I act, the way I speak, the way I think, and more importantly, the way I look at the world.
Mm-hmm. How they come to change your point of view?
You know,
how they come to change you as a human being?
Even the tiniest things that happens in our communication, okay? For example, I go to, I don't know, kind of gathering with my friends, with my best friend. And she, for example, tells me something touching, only one sentence. And I would think about that one sentence whole day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know, is this a bad habit or not, but I have this habit of overthinking everything.
No, it happens. It's a moment of manifestation.
This is really beautiful. I like it. The moments that I go deep in whatever other people tell me. And I feel like, okay, maybe this is the time that you have to understand from other people's experiences.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stop yourself from being like, no, I have to experience it myself. I have to learn it myself. And just let yourself be and get drowned into other people's ocean.
Yeah. You know, there's something about me, myself, I want to share in here. Well, I have a friend and our friendship goes back to more than 70 years. So just imagine how lovely she is to me and how much I love her and what kind of bond we have together. She's more of a sister than anything else. And just to add to your surprise, she's not living with me in the same city. We are far away from each other. But then our hearts are too close to each other. And I just can't stop thinking about the first day I met her. Just if we didn't meet at that moment, just if we didn't sit at that moment together, just if another friend didn't come in the middle and say, okay, this is my friend. And, you know, she just introduced us to each other and then the story started. You know, everything happens as a miracle. And I do believe that some encounters, some people that get to come into your lives are going to act as the angels into your life, the angels that are going to be given as a reward to you. And some others, on the contrary, they're going to take you into an ocean, into a windy ocean of problems that you have to change afterward. So, brother, do you have some of these experiences, some of them that made great changes in you and your personality?
Yeah, the thing is, you know, as we know the fact, like, you know, so many people in this world, so some people come and go, some people stay, and some people leave us. Mm-hmm. So actually, the thing you mentioned earlier was actually a very good point. Like, you know, some people come to our lives as a reward, and some people come as a disaster. So, but one important thing over here is this is actually the first step. You know, someone might come as a reward, and someone might come as a disaster. But the result lies in our hands. You know, to be rewarded from them and to be harmed by them.
Yeah.
This whole and solely, it lies in our hands. You know, if we let them stay or if we let them go. So this is how we react to their arrival. Mm-hmm. You know, someone's come to my life. You know, yeah, there are many friends, you know, I have. And in my school and my college, I had many friends. You know, I have like best friends, like since past 8 years, 10 years, we're friends. And in this time, there were many other people as well, like who were there in our circle. But, you know, they were slightly aligned to the wrong path. So,
yeah.
You know, we tried.
So your ways got deviated from each other.
Yeah. So no. Like first we tried to get him on the right track. Like some people who came back to the right path.
Yeah.
But while the others who stay, who stayed deviated, like, you know,
you
like
just let
God
them go.
Knows, like, we just let them go.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is, like, there's one more thing in this. Like, you know, sometimes the opposite happens. You know, the people who are deviated, they spoil others as well. You know, if you're so strong, you can change them, get to the right track.
Yeah.
Or if they do not change, you can just, you know, leave them.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes what happens is when you're trying to change them, you yourself, you are deviated.
Yeah. What
For example, like, you know, when a good fruit is, you know, put beside a spoiled fruit, the other one, you know, it rots as well.
Some of the people that come into our life draw some scars into our heart that we would never forget them. These encounters are also sort of important because the scars would remain in there and we would never forget the outcome, the results, the consequences of those breakages in our heart.
You know, I was sitting in a classroom and my teacher asked someone to give a brief explanation about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, I don't know. Other people can talk about me. Look at this. She is not really self-centered. She is always thinking about what other people think about them. This is all the communications that she has. I mean, this is the beauty of life, that we have some people as rewards, some people as torture, some people as nothing in our lives. But these are just people. okay?
Yeah.
And don't forget that this is you at the end of the day.
And we are, to some extent, we're bound to each other.
Yeah, yeah, we are bound because we're human beings. Yeah. We're social human
beings.
We
have to have interactions.
And these interactions actually doesn't define you to the extent that you can justify yourself from the things that you do.
Exactly. There have been a number of people, like our professors, like our teachers at a school.
Yeah.
Just one sentence from them, maybe they have changed us too much without us consciously knowing that.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
I know.
Many of these people that get to be a part of our life had their effect and they left us.
Yeah.
We don't remember them anymore, but their teachings, the effect and the impact of whatever they said to us is still remaining there as an important part of us. Like, for example, if I'm a brooding person right now, maybe it's because one of my teachers always urged us to be like this. She always urged us to question whatever we see, whatever we do in our life. The teachings of her would stay inside of me, would be there forever. But as we just said, the important thing is that we are the one who's going to define these meetings, these encounters. The things that we learn from them, we're going to take as rewards, no matter if they, even if they were torturers to us. We're going to learn things from them.
One important thing to note over here is, like, we always need to reflect upon ourselves. Like, and sometimes we need to reflect on our company as well. When someone comes into our life, like, you know, someone, a new person comes into our life. So we need to reflect upon this, like, you know, is it making me a better person, or like, is it deviating me from the right path?
And don't give all the people that come to you as in strangers more than enough. It's not good. I guess we have to just give every person enough capacity that is reasonable to be given to them.
I think, and, you know, I think apart from your family, only three or four best friends or someone who is really close to is enough.
Yeah. Well, it depends on people. People are different. We are speaking as introvert people, so that's pretty clear. Yeah, but this was all the people that come to our life has got a mission, and I hope we keep that in mind and think about it. Not all the people are worthy and not all of them are bad. So this is all. Thank you for being with us. Until another session, I leave you to God's never-sleeping eyes. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again.
Welcome to Israel Watch, which showed the doubts that the Zionists have regarding the possibility of achieving the goals of aggression declared by the war regime, while disagreements rage within it regarding the process of the aggression and the mounting pressures from the relatives of the Zionist captives who are being held by the Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip. About these issues, I welcome the expert in Israel's affairs, Mr. Nabil Awatha. You're most welcome, Mr. Awatha. Let the beginning be with the Zionist skepticism that has been increasing on a far scale inside the Zionist entity regarding the Netanyahu's cabinet's goal in its aggression against Gaza Strip. Most important goals have been the elimination of the resistance and freeing the Israeli captives. Of course, the Zionist skepticism is a result of the Israeli military fiasco in its confrontation with the Palestinian resistance, which is inflicting heavy damage in Israel's soldiers and equipment and preventing the enemy from holding the areas into which it penetrated inside Gaza Strip. Mr. Awatha, what is the nature of these skepticism that are being published by the Hebrew media regarding the difficulty in achieving the announced goals in Gaza Strip, beside the calls to wake up from this big illusion?
It's very clear that the main reason for this split is the big failure that occurred in the battlefield, particularly after the huge losses by the Zionist army. From 5 to 10 soldiers are being killed on a daily basis. This phenomenon bounced back inside Israel. The case started with support from the officials, the public opinion, and the media demanding the destruction of the Gaza Strip and Hamas movement, to another stance when the Israeli public opinion divided into two camps. The first one was the camp of the captives, while the second camp belonged to the war advocates. The camp of captives came as a result of the big failure that has been demanding a diplomatic solution to free their relatives or reviving a deal. This reality shows that the military campaign against the Strip failed, particularly after the first truce. The second camp, led by Netanyahu, demands the continuation of the war for an infinite time in order to get benefit of it in other domestic files and entitlements. Because every day of war passes, Netanyahu is strengthening his capabilities and the right-wing coalition inside the regime.
This military failure has been followed by an intelligence fiasco in having information with regard to the health of Mohammed Al-Tayf, the Palestinian leader in Gaza Strip, in light of the conflicting information circulated by the enemy media about his health and physical condition. So with Israel's acknowledgement, the leader Mohammed Al-Tayf is an exception in Hamas movement. What is your opinion with regards to the intelligence failure in following Al-Tayf's health?
In fact, he is the other side of the failure. The failure has a connection with the big goals. At the beginning, the entity kept talking about big events in this campaign, but today he's summarizing the goals in some persons. It wants the elimination of Mohammed Al-Tayf and Yahya al-Sanwar. In other words, it is searching for any goal in order to get a result it can present to the Israeli public opinion as a military achievement. This in itself expresses high military and political positions and the confinement of matters to areas related to the leadership in Gaza. This means the process of descending from the tree has started, or what we call the high positions that are impossible to achieve with these types of operations, according to the latest confession from the Israelis.
But if you have realized the Zionist media has been concentrating on the intelligence failure in the case related to the leader Mohammed Al-Tayf.
No doubt there is tension, so to speak, and divisions regarding the role of the state of intelligence in the entity. Today, the intelligence service in the Zionist entity is facing major criticisms due to this failure on October the 7th. In addition to the failure that has relation to Mohammed Al-Tayf's personality and his whereabouts, and of course Yahya al-Sinwar and other leaders in Hamas movement. This is in itself a part of the internal split and a part of the major failure related to the big goals the Israelis' politicians put for themselves, but so far failed to achieve any of those goals, to the extent that the chief of staff of the armed forces has said it publicly that whoever wants to eliminate Hamas is not sane.
The nightmares of the battles that Israel's army has been involved in against the Palestinian fighters in Gaza Strip have begun to appear among the shock soldiers and the psychological symptoms they were experiencing. Of course, the subject of shock soldiers due to the confrontations with Palestinian fighters has been the main axis of comments in social media.
Rutem, Israel is eating its own children.
Yahav.
How many fighters of our soldiers will be in this psychological condition due to this war?
Orn.
Which corrupt and shameful regime sends people to a battle, and when they return shock, it throws them in a waste container. An unparalleled shame. Shame on you, Netanyahu, and your cabinet.
Shlomi.
All of Israel is in a state of battle shock.
So, all of the Israeli regime is in a state of shock due to the ongoing battles in Gaza Strip. How do you explain such a situation?
The size of the psychological reality has a relation with the soldiers, in particular the reserved ones. Their numbers were big, and they were away from any real battle. More than that, they had a preconceived idea that they were capable of achieving victories should they have participated in any battle. But when they got involved in a real battle, they were shocked. First, some of them were shot by their own comrades. Their number was high. This matter caused a lot of shock to them. As a result of this situation, they lost any trust in who was shooting them, the Palestinian fighters or the Israeli soldiers. This became a reason for confusion, which reflected in the lack of confidence in leadership and in fighting, in addition to another reason, which was their confidence that they have taken control of some streets, but suddenly they would become surprised by the resistance fighters who would come behind them from zero point. As we watched in various documentaries published by resistance groups saying that these images were broadcast live, this matter heavily affected the Israeli troops psychologically. The majority of them are suffering from severe psychological crisis.
Of course, they're being ignored by the Zionist occupation authorities. Anyway, after this military and intelligence failure through the aggression on Gaza, one of the well-known Zionist analysts said in the media, we should have killed 100,000 of Gaza's population at the beginning of the eruption of the battle. This was Tesfi, one of the prominent analysts in Israel, expressed his willingness to see the killing of 100,000 of Gaza's population at the initial strike. What do you get out of this speech as a result for this Zionist brutality?
What this analysis is reflecting is so clear that they wanted this action from the first minute. They were seeking a genocide in Gaza in order to convey a message to Gaza's people that what would happen to you is because of the resistance. We saw the anchor who was surprised by his guest's speech. In other words, he meant that this speech was far away from ethics of war. It was very clear that what the Israelis wanted to do from the beginning in committing a genocide was backed by political and legislative support inside the Israeli regime and the Knesset. We saw and heard several Zionist MPs and ministers who said publicly, like the Minister of Heritage, said, we should throw a nuclear bomb on Gaza. This anchor tries to ease the tension because he was aware about the failure in achieving any one of his cabinet goals. By the way, the same anchor was hoping to achieve his cabinet goals in the first days of the battle.
This Israeli confusion not only reflected upon military and intelligence levels, but a confusion on the political level as well. When differences come to the surface in Netanyahu's cabinet, which is experiencing sharp discussions regarding the ongoing aggression and the ways to terminate it. The Israeli social media sites entered the domestic differences also, putting the responsibility of what happened during Al-Aqsa flood on him and supporting the Zionist activists in their demand to push him to resignation.
The chief of staff didn't know and didn't prepare the army for what happened. He must be the first one to be ousted after the war. Who decided was the regime, and the army is executing its orders. The chief of staff is despicable and a loser. He must go immediately.
Katikat.
Where were you when the observers informed you about what was going on near the fences? We tried to warn you.
Natan.
Netanyahu and his cabinet are disastrous accidents on Israel.
Sigalich.
It's a shame upon Israel. We deserve other leaders.
The disputes within the regime and the war council pushed an ex-prominent general to ask the regime to determine the path of this aggression and the prices the regime is going to pay. So, Mr. Awatha, Netanyahu's cabinet must tell the Zionists where it's taking them in the middle of these differences. What are the meanings of these words, in your opinion?
The basic meaning in this split is the failure, which has got a link to the stance against the army in particular. The best individuals who have got a background of the nature of the battle and its outcome, plus what is going on there, are the military commanders, and in particular, the chief of staff, Hatzal Leiba. By the way, the attack he faced took place with the presence of Netanyahu, Ben-Gavir, and Regev. The attack was unprecedented, in which the chief of staff was accused of preparing for a military coup. And this is what we say is the big problem that has a link to the roots of the battle. These disputes with the army are not new. At the outset of the war, there wasn't any skepticism regarding the army's capabilities. But today, we can see skepticism towards the army to the extent that Netanyahu got involved in all discussions in this context and began a severe criticism against the chief of staff. This is a part of struggle for the power and the alternatives which are connected to the nature of the future regime.
Now we're going to the protest by the relatives and families of the Israeli captives who are extremely worried about the fate of their beloved ones after the Israeli army killed three of them. These relatives are holding Netanyahu's cabinet responsible for having their relatives killed. So, Mr. Awatha, the captives' issue is pressurizing Netanyahu's cabinet in a bad way. It's backed off from freeing them by force, of course, after it entered negotiations in Cairo on the hope of signing a new deal. Al-Qassim Brigades broadcast a video clip regarding the death of the three Israeli captives.
The death of the three captives was a coup, so to say. What Netanyahu was seeking achieving, a particular matter that has links to the release of the captives. Should those three captives not have been killed by the Israeli army, we would have seen another image of the war, and the Israeli public opinion would encourage Netanyahu and his regime to continue the mission. But because he failed, and as a result, all the theories to free the captives collapsed, so this development brought him and his regime to the first square.
The front that was opened by Hezbollah in South Lebanon, which seemed more militarily painful to the enemy, who did not expect it every day, the arms being used by the resistance in Lebanon are getting more sophisticated and developed, till we saw the use of ground-to-air missiles against Israeli helicopters. Mr. Awatha, what does the use of these developed weapons from Hezbollah mean to the Zionist entity, particularly the use of ground-to-air missiles targeting Israeli helicopters?
This is a confirmation of combat days in South Lebanon and a wide and a comprehensive war taking place. The level of using weapons means that the battle is so deep and effective, while some voices began to come out from within the entity, saying that what is going on in the North is a real war.
The Israeli leaders vowed to return the settlers to the occupied areas near South Lebanon and pushing back Hezbollah far from the borders. The command that was mocked by the Zionist experts and commentators, amongst them the ex-general Yitzhak Breck. The ex-general is saying to the settlers in the north, be careful and alert.
The general is the shadow of Netanyahu. He is well known that he is a close friend to him. Whatever he says, Netanyahu likes to say it, but he refrains from talking publicly due to the elections and the upcoming political entitlements. What General Brake is saying shows that there is a real war going on in the north, and the resistance in South Lebanon was able to respond to Israel to a very profound extent. What is saying about the security is there in the settlements, not in Lebanese areas.
Mr. Nabih Awatha, the expert in Israeli affairs, many thanks for being with us and participating in this episode of our program, Israel Watch. Many thanks to you for accompanying us in our program. God bless you.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question which is very significant and important. And that question is about the etiquettes of greeting, how we should greet other people. Or let's be more specific, who are the people who we should avoid greeting first? And as you know, it's very recommended to initiate the greeting. You know, when we meet a person, it's good to be the person who initiates the greeting and says, Assalamu alaikum first, he gets more reward than the person who responds to the greeting. This is affirmed, can be affirmed by the hadith. However, in certain cases, this is not true, and is there any exception to this rule? So the answer to this question is yes, there are certain exceptions to this. Fortunately, we have certain hadiths which have been mentioned, in which these have been mentioned, these people. Imam Bakr alayhi salam has been narrated as having said, do not extend the greeting of peace, meaning the assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, to certain people. He mentioned them, and then he said this, and to those who drink alcohol, nor to chess and dice players, meaning this is a specifically, but in general, people who gamblers, nor to an effeminate person, probably a gay or lesbian person, nor to a poet who slanders chaste women of fornication, a poet who accuses good and chaste women of, you know, being bad and of being fornicators, and nor to someone performing his prayers. If somebody's praying, don't say salam alaikum to him and bother him. Then the Imam said, and that is because the person performing prayers cannot return the greeting. For verily, the initiation of the greeting on the part of the greeter is voluntary, whereas returning the greeting is obligatory. Then the Imam said the following, nor greet the usurer, the person who takes usury or gives usury. As you know, usury is something forbidden within Islam, and it's very staunchly prohibited. Nor someone who is sitting in the lavatory, somebody who's relieving himself in the bathroom, it's not good to say salam to them. Nor someone taking a bath, somebody who's taking a shower, it's not good to go and greet them. And nor an outrightly corrupt person who openly commits immoral acts. What this refers to is a person who commits sins out in the open and he's not shameful of them. It's different from, in contrast to the person who might be committing evil acts, but in secret and in secrecy. Not that person, the first person, meaning the person who's not shameful of them and commits them in open, probably because such a person is actually encouraging others, giving them courage to go and do those same immoral acts that he's doing. That's why this person is so bad, and why we have been advised, if we go and say salam to him and greet him, gradually people are going to think that, you know, this person is not so bad. People are, you know, greeting him and saying salam to him. Everybody likes him. There's not really a bad person. Otherwise, people would be detested from him. So it's good to just avoid him and not say salam to him. This is actually a way and a form of Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi al Munkar, to enjoin the good and forbid the evil. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the people who we should avoid greeting and the people who we should not initiate the greeting for in the light of the Quran and Hadith. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio, for those who seek the truth.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of RIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Mahdi Rastani.
When you look at the verses of the Quran, you find out that from the very beginning, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is placing this idea of maintaining your family ties very high up on his lists. So what is the impact of maintaining these ties? That's a question we have to ask. You know, if the Imam was here, we could ask him that question. Discussion for another time. But what you find is that the one who cuts off these family ties, the tone is very harsh. And the hadith of the fifth Imam, when he is in conversation with his father, comes into the picture here. The fifth Imam says, I was in conversation with my father, Imam Sajjad. And my father turned to me, he said, Ya Bunayya, unzur khamsatan. Be careful of five. Five individuals, make sure you keep a distance from them. And the wording of the hadith is very harsh. He said, وَلَا تُحَادِثْهُمْ, don't spend time with them. وَلَا تُرَافِقْهُمْ فِي طَرِيقٍ. If they're walking on a path, you don't walk on that path with them. You distance yourself from these individuals. It's a very harsh tone that the fourth Imam is using. So he says, I asked my father, I said, Ya Abati, arrefinihim, tell me, who are these five people that are so dangerous? I shouldn't even be spending time with them. He says, let me tell you. He said, number one, Iyaka wa musahabatul kadhab. He said, make sure you stay away from the one who lies. Why? He said, فَإِنَّهُ بِمَنْزِلَةِ السَّرَابِ. He's like a mirage. He will take things that are far from you and make them look like they are close to you. And things that are close to you, they're about to happen to you, but he will make it look as if it's something that you have years of time to deal with. He said, don't spend time with the one who lies. Number one. Number two, إِيَّاكَ وَمُصَاحَبَةُ الْفَاسِقِ. Don't spend time with the one who openly and publicly sins, who gives himself a green light to sin. He said, this person should not be your best friend. Why? He said, فَإِنَّهُ بَائِعُكَ بِأَكْلَةٍ. When the time comes, he'll sell you. When you need his loyalty, he won't be there for you. Number three, إِيَّاكَ وَمُصَاحَبَةُ الْبَخِيلِ. Make sure you stay away from the one who is stingy. What's the problem with the one who's stingy? He said, when you need his money the most, he will humiliate you and he will not give you of his wealth. He will withhold his wealth at a time where you are severely in need of it. Number four, إِيَّاكَ وَمُصَاحَبَةُ الْأَحْمَقِ. Make sure you stay away from the fool, the one who is naive. Looks at life in too much of a simplistic way. If you remember, we talked about this person on the second night. The one who opens his mouth, whatever is true, he says it. He said, you stay away from this person. Why? Why should I stay away from him? He said, because this person will try to help you, but he'll end up hurting you in the process. He wants to help you. He has good intentions, but he'll end up hurting you at the end of the day. And then he came to the fifth one. He said, إِيَّاكَ وَمُصَاحَبَةُ الْقَاطِعِ لِرَحِمِهِ. Make sure you stay away from the one who cuts off his family ties. Why? Why should I stay away from this one? He said, فَإِنَّهُ مَلْعُونٌ. He has been cursed three times in the verses of the Quran. Very harsh. Very harsh. Why? Why, Ya Allah? Why is it so harsh? That's a question to be asked. What type of effect does it have on a Muslim community and a Muslim society if families are, you know, torn apart and the ties have broken apart completely? That's a valid question to ask. But this question for another time, of course. But you find the tone is a very harsh tone. He says three times in the verses of the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has cursed this individual. This shows you how emphatic Islam is about this issue. And you see this in the other teachings of Islam as well. When the person is leaving this world, he's passing away, and he is leaving behind an inheritance. Many of us growing up in this society and living in this society, you might have seen in movies, this person has his will. He takes this person out of his will and he says, leave my house to this person and leave this to this person and leave that to this person. We assume that the wills in Islam are also like this. You just get to choose who gets what. In reality, it's not like that. There's limitations, yes. A certain portion of the wealth you leave behind, yes. But a certain portion of the wealth, Islam says, has to go to this relative. Well, I can't take him off the will? Not necessarily. Sometimes with certain conditions, yes, he's off the will automatically. But not just because you don't like him. There's something going on with this concept of relatives that's so important to Muslim society and Muslim community that from every direction Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is really trying to protect it. What is that? I honestly don't know. All we know is that it's extremely important. Then you find in hadith, people used to come to the imams and they used to speak of the situations that maybe many of us deal with. Up until now, we were talking about maintaining family ties. Yes, Shaykh, in an ideal situation, no one's going to cut off ties with their family members. We don't even need Islam to tell us that. But it's when things are difficult, when things are tricky. So this individual came to Imam al-Sadiq on one occasion. He said, Ya Ibn Rasulullah, this relative of mine, his lifestyle is different. I mean, he sins, he does everything. Can I cut off ties with him completely? The Imam told him, no, you can't do that. Another companion came to the sixth imam. Say, Ya Ibn Rasulullah, this relative of mine, he does not even know of this amr. He does not know of this affair. He does not know of this issue. In hadith, when they say amr, they're referring to the issue of imama. Say, he doesn't even know. He doesn't even believe in the school of thought. Can I cut off family ties with him? The response was no. Third occasion, these are all in Al-Kafi, by the way. Third occasion, the person comes to the imam, another person. He says, Ya Ibn Rasulullah, this person's not even Muslim. Can I cut off family ties with him? And Imam al-Sadiq responded to him so beautifully. He said, if this relative of yours was a Muslim, he would have had two rights upon you. The right of Islam and the right of being your relative. But you're saying he's not Muslim, so he only has one right upon you. You can't cut off family ties with him. You have to maintain family ties with him. This emphasis that Islam has placed on this issue. And you also find this in the life of the Prophet, the seerah of the Prophet. Those individuals who helped him very early on when he was nobody. He was nothing to anyone. Early on, our Prophet was just a yatim. Early on, that's who he was. According to some narrations, people didn't even want to take him as a child. Some scholars say this. They say he was in a situation where people said he's yatim, we don't even want him. That's how he ended up with Halima, according to some narrations. But later on in his life, he became this prophet and these companions and all of that. But he never forgot the good that his relatives did unto him. 30, 40 years later, after he was a prophet, when Halima used to come, and the husband of Halima used to come, you see the respect that the prophet used to give to Halima. That the narration says when Halima used to come, or the husband of Halima used to show up, he used to take off his own aba, and he used to spread it under the husband of Halima. And then the narration says Halima joined, and then he spread it even more, and he asked Halima to sit as well. And amongst those women who also aided the Prophet when he was nobody, Fatima bint Asad, the mother of Ali ibn Abi Talib. And you find that he never forgot the work that Fatima bint Asad did for him when he was a yatim and when he was an orphan. The Prophet used to hold on to these relationships. When Fatima bint Asad was leaving this world or had passed away, and they wanted to bury the body of the mother of Ali ibn Abi Talib, he turned to Ali. He said, Ya Ali, if Fatima was a mother for you, she was also a mother for me as well. And he was sad on that day when Fatima bint Asad was leaving this world. But Ya Rasulullah, Halima was 30, 40 years ago. You were a child then. He says, no, these ties, These relationships are very important for me. So this is all of the emphasis that you find in Islam to maintain these family ties.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
Midstream.
Warning the martyrs of the Gaza Strip, Palestinian Christians will not celebrate Christmas this year. The holiday rituals will be limited to prayers, which will also be hindered, especially in the occupied city of Al-Quds. Zionist Israel has turned the city of Al-Quds into military barracks throughout the year, currently deploying its checkpoints and police forces in all alleys, streets, and squares. This is accompanied by direct assaults by soldiers and settlers obstructing the lives of Al-Quds residents, including their prayers, without any freedom. Palestinian Christians have not only canceled holiday celebrations, but have also in recent weeks sent letters to all religious and human rights authorities worldwide, urging them to work to stop the genocide against Gaza. At the same time, condemnations continue for the visit by the heads of Christian churches in Al-Quds to the residence of Israeli entity President Isaac Herzog during the holiday season. Among the condemnations was a statement from the Pastoral Council of the Ramallah Roman Catholic Melkite Church, which denounced the meeting, saying, "Such meetings do not represent us and are not related to us." Targeting Christians in Gaza as well as in the West Bank or occupied Al-Quds did not begin with the start of the aggression, but extends back before that. Reference is made here to the attacks suffered by Christian clergy in early October prior to the Al-Aqsa flood battle from assaults by settler groups in Al-Quds involving physical violence and spitting, in addition to attacks by occupation police forces. Commenting on this incident at the time, the World Council of Churches in Al-Quds stated that Christians are facing persecution from Zionist Israeli extremist groups, criticizing the Israeli entity government's silence on the matter and adding, "We feel persecuted as Christians and for Christianity as a religion in the country. There is Israeli Jewish persecution that is encouraged either through police negligence or through the statements made by Israeli government ministers." Now, the harassment is not limited to determining the numbers of worshippers and the paths they take in Al-Quds. It extends to the collaboration of the occupation police with settlers and Zionist right-wing extremist groups who roam the neighborhoods and alleys of the city. Christian believers are subjected to insults and verbal abuse. On many occasions, the occupation police intervene and physically assault them in case of disputes with settlers who regularly spit at Christian believers wherever they see them. Now, Minister of National Security Itamar Ben-Gvir defended those acts, saying, "There is an ancient Jewish custom to spit when passing near a monastery or priest, and you can agree with it or disagree." Ben-Gvir then questioned, "Why do we turn spitting on Christians into a criminal offense?" "I know, it angers me too. Spit back on the occupation and only then Christmas will be merry again," Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Mara Osman. In a show of solidarity with the Palestinians of Gaza and the devastation there, church leaders in Bethlehem and elsewhere in the Palestinian Holy Land have asked local Christians to avoid public displays of celebration and to instead intensify their prayers for the war's innocent victims. Bethlehem municipal authorities, too, announced the removal of previously installed Christmas decorations in solidarity with our people in Gaza. To discuss this issue with us from Damascus, Syria, is Father Elias Zahlawi, a Catholic priest of the Church of Our Lady of Damascus. Father Zahlawi, it's an honor to have you with us, especially on these very tough, devastating days with Christmas being on the verge of these very devastating days now. As you know, there is no Christmas in Bethlehem this year. Actually, there's no Christmas in all of Palestine, all of the region of West Asia, with the U.S. Zionist Israeli war on the Gaza Strip. Festivities are off. This year, there will be no Christmas in the city that is synonymous with the birth of Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, because of the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Now, as a man of the church yourself, what does this cancellation mean to you and to your parish?
I wonder, what is the significance of celebrating the birth of Christ, who brought to the world the most profound meanings of God and humanity? I question what this celebration has turned into. Regardless of religious observances, the current events have no connection to the birth of the one who carried the perfect image of God and humanity. Whether they observe religious festivities or not, what is happening today, starting from Palestine and extending worldwide, is unlike what Christ intended with his birth in Bethlehem. He came glorifying God. But what unfolds today from Palestine across the globe reminds us of Herod's actions after the birth of Jesus Christ, where he slaughtered children in Bethlehem in an attempt to eliminate the newborn Jesus. Today's events, heard and seen globally, including by all churches, notably the Vatican, are unimaginable and unacceptable to both God and humanity. Whether celebrated or not, Jesus Christ has no association with this holiday or its celebrations. That's my perspective.
Father Zahlawi, knowing that churches were not spared in the Zionist Israeli attack on Gaza, where Christians who were displaced civilians who found refuge in the churches of Gaza, were targeted and they were martyred inside of their churches. What do you think priests this Christmas should do or should say to their pastoral activities, to their parish, to urge them to stand strong, maybe to support those that are facing the war in the Gaza Strip and also in the occupied West Bank, because we have been seeing this kind of discrimination against especially the Christian believers as well as the Muslim ones in Al-Quds city as well?
What is required from those representing Christ, regardless of their rank in the church, whether an ordinary being, a bishop, a patriarch, a cardinal, or the Pope in Rome, is to speak as Jesus did out of love for humanity and in reverence to God. All denominations have remained silent today, especially the Western churches. While it's true that the Al-Aqsa flood began on the 7th of October and the Pope spoke on the 16th of December following the killing of two Christian women in a Gaza church, I would like to ask the Pope and all Western churches, are these two women the only ones worthy of concern among the human category, while thousands of children, women and men were martyred in Gaza? Why did His Holiness the Pope speak only after the assassination of two Christian women in Gaza? And neither he nor any bishop in the West or East spoke out about the killing of tens of thousands of children and women. Why this silence? I wonder, and openly pose the question awaiting an answer.
Father Zahrawi, we saw that heads of Christian churches in Al-Quds visited last week the residence of the Israeli entity president, Isaac Herzog, and they even took public photographs with the man while the Christians of Gaza were being killed under the rubble of their own churches because of the Israeli Zionist bombings. And the Christians of Al-Quds are being harassed. They are being even spat on by the occupation soldiers and settlers. What message would you send to those heads of Christian churches after their visit to the head of the Zionist entity?
When I read the news about the meeting of leaders from different Christian denominations in Al-Quds with the head of the Zionist entity, I felt deep sorrow. However, I found some consolation when I learned that a priest from the Catholic Church in Ramallah protested against the project of the Christian leaders meeting with the head of the Zionist entity. But I truly wonder about this silence. Churchmen are not required to carry weapons. They are required to uphold the words of Jesus. Jesus' words are a defense of God, for God is love and justice, defending every human being, especially in the land of the Christ. What has been happening there for 75 years is a complete denial of all that Jesus Christ carried for humanity: light, love, dignity, and peace. I don't ask churchmen to bear arms. I only ask them to say what Jesus said. Jesus did not carry a weapon. He carried words, and his words changed the world. Today, why do we submit in the name of money and power to authorities that destroy the values of God and human values? It's time for us to wake up and trust that everything happening in Gaza today will be the beginning of a change globally, as change has already started at the grassroots level. As for governments, unfortunately, even some Arab governments have become entangled with Zionism. However, the people have risen. We have even heard officials in America say that what is happening in Gaza liberated us in America. I believe we are facing the birth of a new world.
Father Zahrawi, in less than 1 minute, what could you say? What is your message to the people of Gaza at these very difficult times on Christmas Day?
Being in the Church of Our Lady in Damascus, I remember only this. 2,000 years ago, someone came to Damascus carrying an absolute hostility towards Christianity. In Damascus, Christ appeared to him, transformed his heart, and he became the greatest evangelist known to Christianity. That was the fate of Saul, who became Saint Paul. Today, I hope that from Gaza, a new light will emerge, a new direction for a new world. I earnestly hope for it from the bottom of my heart. And I ask the Allah, the God of the heavens and the earth, to bestow his grace upon all humans, even upon the oppressors, restoring their dignity as human beings, bringing them peace and love as humans. May humanity experience a period of safety, joy, and tranquility, at the least for a while. Peace be with you.
Father Zahrawi, thank you very, very much on this very special day for being with us from Syria, from Damascus. Father Elias Zahrawi, a Catholic priest of the Church of Our Lady of Damascus, Merry Christmas to you and to all your parish and to all the Christians, especially the Christians of West Asia, who have been suffering under the occupation in the occupied Holy Lands of Palestine. Thank you very much for being with us and for giving us a bit of your time on Christmas Day. Ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how the Iraqi resistance is supporting our brothers and sisters in Gaza.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Since October 17, 2023, Iraqi resistance factions have been actively involved in the latest conflicts that broke out in West Asia on October 7, known as Al-Aqsa Flood Operation. As part of their role in the axis of resistance, these Iraqi factions targeted U.S. occupation military bases in Syria and Iraq with about 110 attacks, using bomber drones, Grad and Katyusha missiles, all the way to threatening to use precise long and medium-range missiles. More details in the following report.
The Islamic resistance in Iraq threatened to escalate attacks with drones and missiles against U.S. occupation bases in Iraq and Syria with the continuation of the U.S.-covered Israeli entity aggression on the Gaza Strip, a possibility for which Washington says has prepared for by strengthening its missile systems deployed in the region. Meanwhile, the Islamic resistance in Iraq announced at dawn on Friday, December 22, that it had managed to strike a target in the Zionist illegal settlement of Eilat. The resistance said in a statement, "In continuation of our approach to resisting the occupation in support of our people in Gaza and in response to the massacres committed by the usurping entity against Palestinian civilians, including children, women, and the elderly, the Mujahideen of the Islamic resistance in Iraq targeted the